And the word executed really isn't the right word to use. You execute criminals. Jesus was not a criminal. The word assassinate would come nearer describing the action against him. Why did they assassinate him? If you really want to get down to it, the bare bones of it, why did they murder him? Why did otherwise honorable people stoop to murder a man that had never hurt anybody? The reason why we're looking at this, and we'll be doing so for the next 6 or 8 weeks, is to try to determine why it was that what there was about him, what there was that so captivated him that it would drive him to lay his life down for that. What was there about him? What was there that so captured him that he was willing to go to the gallows for it? That would cause him to take a bullet for it. That would cause him to go to an instrument of torture perfected by the Roman government. And you might say, well, it was people. He laid his life down for people, and I know that. But you know, you can say that in such a way and so spiritualize it and gloss over it that you miss the contributing factors that precipitated it. We stand in such danger of just accepting something he laid his life down for. You see, it wasn't that he went to the authorities and said, I love these people and I want to lay my life down for them. Oh, that's such a simplistic approach, and I don't think that maybe we would do it consciously, but we have heard it so many times that he laid his life down for people, that he so loved the world that he gave his life for them. That's true, but that's just an overview of it. What were the mechanics and what were the guts and what was the inside and what were the contributing factors that caused the religious leaders and that caused the established authorities to become so locked in conflict with this man that they actually devised means by which they could exterminate him? And the reason why I want us to look at it is if we can figure out what it was that he thought was valuable enough that he would give his life for it, I think we'll come close to finding what it is that will be valuable enough to cause us to do the same. That's what I'm hoping that will happen. How do you think Jesus wanted to be remembered? If you could ask him, you'd call him up here today, ask him, how did you want to be remembered? What do you think he would say? If you looked at the answer through our eyes, people's eyes, you'd come up with perhaps a different conclusion. Without some serious reflection, you'd come up with a different conclusion. Because of the way we have left paintings and sculptings in our path. Paintings depict him as a little baby in a cradle, in a manger. Or they depict him perpetually hanging from a cross. And he's known as the crucifix. And the Roman church has pictured him either as a baby in a cradle, the manger, or as a perpetually crucified one. Or pictured him with a halo over his head. And that's been the major depiction of Jesus in art and sculpting down through nearly 2,000 years. Or he's been pictured as being very gentle and meek and mild, as a man that would not hurt a fly. He's been pictured almost as being effeminate. And this is a travesty, it's a tragedy. There's a picture that perhaps you've not seen. It hangs in the church building in Muskogee, Oklahoma, as well as other places. It's called the Laughing Christ, the Laughing Jesus. And you've seen it? It has his head thrown back in this hilarious, joyful outburst of laughter. We don't usually think of him like that. It's a marvelous depiction of him in a way that is a bit unusual. But how do you think he wanted to be remembered? He wasn't, or he didn't appear to be, at least the most religious man in Israel. He did go to church. He went to the synagogue every Sabbath. Luke says that was his custom, and which meant that he could be counted on. He was there regularly every Sabbath day. He went to the assembly, and he was even a reader. And it says, as his custom was, he stood up to read. So evidently he had been given the job of reading much like you did today. There was a reading, except it was, he was visible. They stood up. He stood. The reader stood to read. He stood up. They gave him the scroll of Isaiah in Luke 4, and he began reading. They waited until he turned or rolled the thing to where he turned to the passage that he quoted, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me." So he was a religious man in that sense, but he didn't look all that religious in terms of the way people looked at religious people of his day. He didn't go around in long flowing robes with phylacteries and broadened garment borders. He didn't stand around on street corners and pray. He didn't go around with a sad, soured look on his face as though he were fasting. In fact, he appeared to be almost irreligious. He didn't look the part of being a religious person. He looked almost irreligious. He didn't always wash before he ate food. And that was not just poor etiquette. That had a reflection on the religion. Because they weren't washing out of being etiquette right, if that's a word. That was a religious ritual through which they went to indicate that they were separate people, that they were special people. And so he shocked them when he sat down and just started eating. He didn't wash first. He hung around people who were disreputable. He associated with the outcasts. He could be found among people who were tax collectors and prostitutes and people who had been divorced and remarried several times and people who were adulterers. He consorted with those kinds of people. He had a reputation of being a glutton and a drunkard. Can you imagine that? That's the way, that's what had developed. He was that sort of a person, to where his reputation was actually set. And you know what, whether that was his character or not, we know from looking at him on a Broadway, he was not a drunkard and a glutton, but he did go to a lot of dinners. And he did, on one occasion, prepare 180 gallons of wine for a feast. And that was after the guests had already drunk up the other wine. And he makes 180 gallons more? Well, you said that was grape juice. Oh no, it wasn't. No, it was the kind of wine that dulls the taste. And usually the host said, look, he called the bridegroom and said, you know, usually people give the good wine first and save the bad wine till after men have drunk enough that they don't really care what they taste like. But he said, you've saved the best wine until last. So whatever, his reputation had come to be a glutton and a drunkard. He was not viewed by contemporaries as the most patriotic Jew either. He complimented, spoke highly of Roman occupation forces. He advised his fellow countrymen to cooperate with them. He advised them, in a sense, it seemed to capitulate to them. If they ask you to go 1 mile, go with them too. Pray for those that persecute you. Do good to those that would despitefully use you. And he held up centurions as being men who were to be emulated. They were given as examples. So he didn't appear to be a very patriotic man. And he often held up people of other races as examples. Not just Romans, not just centurions, but he held up Samaritans and Syrians and people who were not Jewish people and said, you ought to be like these people. I think they looked at him, his critics looked at him as a one-worlder. That'll make sense to us today because we have going on today something that people look down on. Oh, you're a one-worlder. You're no longer an American, you're a one-worlder. They looked at Jesus, well, you're no longer Jewish, you're a one-worlder. These are some of the things, this is how they remembered him. His admirers viewed him as teacher and Lord. And rightly so, according to him in John 13, he said, you call me teacher and Lord. And you're right, he said, I am. His critics looked upon him as an imposter, as a blasphemer. They looked at him in such a way that wasn't very complimentary. How did he want to be remembered is what I'm asking this morning. How do you think he wanted to be remembered? If we had him here this morning, he could say, Jesus, What were you trying to communicate? How did you really want people to see you? What do you think he would say? I'm going to say something that I've never said before, and I think I'll say it again later whenever I have opportunity. I think Jesus would not object to having been remembered as a fighter. As a fighter. Now you say, well, no, surely not. I think so. Even though in Isaiah it said he will not strive nor cry aloud. Neither will his voice be heard in the streets. He was not going to be a rambunctious, riotous fellow. He wasn't going to call attention a lot to that was not the nature of his ministry in general terms. It was not the general drift of his ministry to be known as a rambunctious, riotous person. That's not right. And yet I think he would not object to being called a fighter. One of the last descriptions he gave of himself is that of being astride a white horse. You remember that one in John, in Revelation, in the 19th chapter and verse 11 beginning, when it says, I saw heaven standing open, and there before me was a white horse whose rider is called Faithful and True. With justice he judges and makes war. His eyes are like blazing fire, and on his head are many crowns. He has a name written on him that no one but himself knows. He is dressed in a robe dipped in blood, and his name is the Word of God. The armies of heaven were following him, riding on white horses and dressed in fine linen, white and clean. Out of his mouth comes a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations. He will rule them with a rod of iron. He treads the winepress of the fury of God Almighty. On his robe and on his thigh, he has his name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. So really, that's one of the last pictures that he gives us. That's in the 19th chapter. You just have the 20th chapter. It's one of the last pictures that he gives us. He wouldn't have had it recorded like that if he had objected totally to being known as a fighter. The man was known as a fighter. But it's something more than that that I'm referring to today. That may be figurative. I can't determine whether that was totally figurative or not. I know it's real, but I'm not sure whether it will actually be a white horse or whatever it was. That's how he chose to depict himself to John and then have him communicate that to us today. But then in addition to that, whether it be literal or figurative, it's real. But in addition to that, he has these references to where he lays down his life for people. Where he says, greater love has no man, you read this morning, greater love has no man than this, than a man lay down his life for his friends. And you have John saying, by this we know love, that he laid his life down for us. That's 1 John 3:16. And then he also, Paul mentions more than one time, how that Christ loved him and gave himself for him. But see, all those are passive, or they're really middle verbs, to lay your life down, to give yourself. Those are all middle verbs, but they have the force of a passive. But that doesn't, you know, it has kind of smoothed over the nature of the man, that he was passive. But he made the statement once. He said, I am laying down my life on my own accord. They're not taking it away from me. In other words, he was the one in charge. He was the initiator. He was doing whatever he did. And we mustn't be blinded to the fact that some circumstances caused it to happen. This is not a fairy tale. What we're reading here are the records of, and they're verified records, they're valid. These records record the events that led up to the execution. A travesty of justice, something that serves today and always has, but increasingly so, as the hinge of history. The hinge of history was the day that he died on the cross. But it was not a plaything. The circumstances that led up to it were such that you have good men, people who were honorable men, people who were at least hoping to be religious men. You have them stooping so low as to plan premeditatedly the murder of a man who never hurt anybody. What made them do it? And what made him push them to the limit as he pushed them? A man wrote a book called The Passover Plot. And you may have read it. His name escapes me right now. Schoenfield wrote a book called The Passover Plot, in which he, as an atheist, the man is an atheistic Jew, at least he's not a believer in Jesus of Nazareth as the Christ. In that book, he said, it is quite clear that Jesus was the architect of his own execution. And then he cites all those examples where Jesus baited these men and flaunted in front of them things that he knew would infuriate them and things that pushed these people to the very brink, and then he would draw back because the time wasn't right, and he became literally the one who was orchestrating the whole execution, the whole Passover plot. He was the architect of it. What was there? What bells did he ring? What buttons did he push in these respectable people that would cause them to stoop so low as to execute him, as to assassinate him, as to murder him? I think when you find out what it was that was so close to him that he said, I'm willing to die for this. I'm willing to give my life for it. I think we'll figure out what it was about. Unquestionably, Jesus was a man who fought for people. And I don't know whether, if we ask him, what did you want to be remembered as? But I suspect that he would say, I would like to be known as a man who fought for people. Isn't that neat that that's, now, and that's not just surmising. This is coming, we're drawing this from his own statements, his own actions. We're drawing it from the overall picture of his life. I think he would like to be known as a fighter, but as a person who fought for people. I think he was obsessed with people. I think he was obsessed in taking care of people and seeing that they got a fair shake. Oh, his first description of himself in Luke, the 4th chapter, whenever he laid down the plank of proposal or of his campaign or whatever you want to call it. Listen to the planks whenever he read as he stood up in the synagogue, as was his custom. And he stood up to read. The scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. Unrolling it, he found the place where it is written. Listen to this. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, the release of the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. Watch him as he pictures himself in this prophecy as being the one appointed and anointed to preach good news to the poor, proclaim freedom to prisoners, recovery of sight to the blind, release of the oppressed, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. All of this had to do with people. He was a person who himself, at the very beginning, wanted to be known as a fighter for people. And that's what got him into his life each day. That's what got him up in the mornings. That's what got him down the road. It's what set his direction. That's why he did what he did. That's why he said what he said. That's why he taught what he taught. That's why he told the stories that he told. He was fighting for people. And I just believe that if we can come to that conclusion, and here's where it then begins to multiply exponentially. It begins to multiply at such a rate that it's not just adding evidence to evidence. It begins to explode, because in our search, what we're going to be doing for the next week or next 8 or so weeks is to try to find out what was so important to him that it would cause him to do what he did, so that we can find something important enough to get us out of the bed in the morning, to determine our course, to propel us down through the years of our lives. Here's what is so startling about it. When you see the way he gave his life for people, how he stood up for people, and we're going to watch it as he does it. We'll not notice it this morning. This is just the basic principle. But we're going to see him do it over and over and over again. But then when you look at him and hear him say, this is why I have come, he makes the statement, the Son of Man came To do what? Not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. He also said, the Son of Man came to do the will of his Father. He said, my will is to do the will of him that sent me. I didn't come to do my own will. And then in John, the 4th chapter, he makes this statement, and it converges, intersects with this other, his care for people and his doing the will of God. What I'm maintaining this morning is that his taking care of people and his fighting for people, that was the will of God for him. That's what God's will was for him to do. It was God's will that he fight for people. You remember the day he was on his way from Judea up to Galilee and he passed through Samaria? And he sat there at the well in Sychar. And the woman came to the well and he was there talking with her while his disciples were out getting lunch. And you remember when they came back and they said, she left. She dropped her water pot and ran into the city. And they said, here, Lord, here's your meal. And he said, I'm not hungry, essentially. He said, I have meat to eat that you don't know about. And they said, what, has somebody brought him his food? And then he said, listen to this. He said, my meat is to do the will of him who sent me. But what was it that had so filled him up at that point that he didn't want to eat? Have you ever had something so excite you that you weren't hungry? Have you ever had something so exciting that you couldn't really be, you're not interested in food? That's what happened on that occasion. But watch how, doing the will of his Father, he said, this is my meat to do the will of my Father. But it was set in the context of talking to a woman who had been married 5 times and was now living with a man in open adultery. He wasn't even her husband. It was in that context, after having dealt with her need and after having sent her to get her husband, and she said, I don't have one, and she ran off to get some, the whole city came out. But it was in that context where he said, my food, what really feeds me is to do the will of my Father. That, to me, causes my perception of his mission to take on such a depth and such an explosive impetus that I just have to stand back and say, whoa, you mean to tell me that it was God's will that he lay his life down and stand up as a fighter for people? Is that what you're saying? That's exactly what I'm saying. Because it meant flying in the face of established religion. It meant that it involved fighting. And that's where we find ourselves. In the next few weeks, we're going to be looking at him fighting. He's going to be fighting over different issues. But Jesus fought at the point. He fought precisely at the point. And he fought only at the point where it involved people. That's just it, pure and simple. He laid his life down for people. And this really tells the whole story. He didn't spend much time debating issues. If you'll notice, he didn't spend much time debating issues. Now, he did sometimes, but it always involved people. It always involved people. He told stories that involved people. He told stories that caused other people to think how they were treating people. And so it is here. Because it meant flying in the face of established religion. And it's sad, but it's true, that established religion so many times becomes the oppressor of people. And Jesus stood up and said, you're not going to treat these people like that. Do you know what the drama, the outlay, or the, you know what the scheme of drama is? All drama? All drama, all movies, all stage plays, I say all, 90%, 95% have this. There are three characters. What are the three characters that exist in any drama that you'll spend 5 minutes reading? And if you don't find these three in it, you'll say, no, I don't want to read that. Who are the three universal characters? There's the victim, the villain, and the hero. The villain, the victim, and the hero. In every one. You know, you ever read Popeye? Who is the villain in Popeye? Brutus. Bluto. B-L-U, I think he has two different, Bluto, I think is the way I knew him. 50 years ago. Who is the victim in Popeye? Olive oil. Who is the hero in Popeye? Popeye. Oh, you know, you have any others? You can name them. There's not a movie, A grade, B grade, there's not any kind of a movie that doesn't have a victim and a villain and a hero, Superman, and whoever it is. And you know, in the westerns, you have those men, you have the woman being tied to a rail. Remember the classic description? She's tied to the railroad, and the villain is standing back after having tied her to the railroad, and he's twisting his mustache and laughing. and he's got this fiendish gleam in his eye, and then all of a sudden over the hill comes the hero, and he comes and runs the villain off, cuts the rope, and rescues the girl, and they go riding off into the sunset. Now you can name it over and over and over. Carmen, you can tell us about how many of the operas have that theme. They all have those. They're universal figures. In the life of Jesus of Nazareth, that is the same dramatic. It's the same scheme. It's the same theme. And here's the thing about it: the people were the victims. The established religion was the villain, and Jesus of Nazareth was the hero. And it's that way all the way through his life. He didn't spend much time debating issues, unless people were involved. His life was consumed with defending people. And in this, we see this classic drama of the victim, the villain, and the hero. And here we see a side of his personality that we often maybe overlook. This man was able to get angry. I don't mean just lightly angry. He was able to get angry and glare at people. In one of the synagogue scenes, I forget what town it was, I think maybe it was Capernaum. He was there, and it was a Sabbath, and he was, of course, in church. When he was out of town, he went to church. He went to the synagogue on the Sabbath, and there was a man standing there who had a withered hand. And he had the man to stand up, and he said, come up here to the front. And the man came up to the front. And then he said, tell me, is it right on the Sabbath day to do harm or do good? To heal a life or to take a life? And they wouldn't answer him. And it says he looked upon them with anger. He looked around, and the word indicates he just scanned. He panned the whole group and just stared them down. And then he said, you hypocrites. You hypocrites. You'll loose your ox or your ass on the Sabbath and lead him away to water. And on another occasion, it talked about a woman being loosed from her 18-year imprisonment in her body. She couldn't raise up. On this occasion, he just simply said, it's right to do good on the Sabbath. And he had the man extend his hand, and it was restored. On another occasion, he came to violence. You know what I'm talking about. At least one time, and maybe twice, John records it at the first of his ministry. The other three synoptics recorded at the end of his ministry. It may have happened twice. At least it happened one time when he became so infuriated with the way that the religious leaders were abusing the poor people. You see, you could buy outside the precincts of the temple a sacrifice at 1/6 of the cost that it cost to buy it inside the precinct. So they were ripping the people off. 5 times they were taking away from the poor people. Instead of being able to buy a dove or 2 pigeons or 2 little wrens outside for a tuppence or a penny, they had to go inside and pay 6 times that much in order to have them accepted by the priest. And he saw that going on. He saw it going on daily. And he had seen it going on for years and years and years and years. So finally, it just simply overburdened him. It wore him out, and he just simply could not stand it any longer, watching the oppression of the poor people by those who should have been protecting them. And he made a whip out of cords, out of leather cords, and he went in there and began to flip money changers' tables. He began to turn them over. He began to take the bowls, and this indicates a premeditated action. It says he took the bowls and dumped out their money. It was not that he pushed the table aside and said, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to turn over your money. No, he said, here, let me have that bowl. And he dumped it out, and the coins went all over the place. And he began then to run the people out and to drive out the oxen and say, take these things and get them out of here. And those who sold the birds, he said, get these things out of here. How dare you turn my father's house into a den of thieves? He was a fighter for people. And that did him in. Immediately after that, Mark says that the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they went out with the Herodians and made plans to kill him. He was a fighter for people. Here's one last thought I want to make before we close, but I wanted us to get this overall picture about him. He became angry. He became violent. But you know what? He never became angry or violent at what was done to him. It was only what was done to other people. That's what made him angry. There's not one single example of where he ever got angry for something being done to him. He was calm as a cucumber when it came to that. That did not push his button. But I'll tell you one thing. You abuse people. And there was another factor in it. You deprive God of his honor or deprive people of their rightful needs. And you better watch out. You'll have him to deal with. And don't think that he was not adequate to take care of the task at hand. But it did him in. They killed him for it. Now, there are many other examples. We're going to be looking at them through the weeks. You're going to love watching him walk. You're going to love watching him fight. You're going to love watching him as he orchestrated this Passover plot, as he began to arrange and to just simply orchestrate it, as this man said of him. You're going to see it, and you're going to love to watch him as he was willing to lay his life down for people. Now I want to ask you a question. What is there about your life that is meaningful enough that you're willing to live for it and are willing to go to the gallows for it? Is there something, perhaps a bit more personal, what makes you angry? Is it what's done to other people or what's done to you? You see how different we are from him? You see how far we have to go? You see, what made him angry was the way other people were treated and the way other people were deprived and the way God was deprived of his honor. What is it that makes you angry? Do you get angry when people are abused? Do you get angry when other people do not get what they need? Is that what makes you angry? Well, I hope so. But when someone does something to you, isn't that where most of your anger comes from? Whenever you are deprived of what you think your rights are, whenever you don't get what you think you have coming to you, and whenever somebody abuses you or when someone slaps you in the face, isn't that what comes nearer making us angry than to see someone else be abused? Well, I don't want to indict any of us, but I just have to read my own heart and know that if I gave in to what was my natural tendency, it would be that I would get angry at what others did to me rather than what others suffered. One final question. If you were to not be here anymore than today, how will this congregation remember you? As one who fights for people and becomes angry when other people are abused, or as someone who is selfish and becomes angry when something is done against them? How will you be remembered? The overall purpose of what we're doing, and we're going to be looking at that pushed his button, that which engaged him, that which got him up out of the bed, that which occupied his time, that which absorbed his energies, that which he found so important that he was willing to stand in the face of established authority and say, "You are not going to treat these people like that. If it means that you do it, you'll have to do it over my dead body." And that is precisely what they did. And we're his followers. Will you be remembered for the same thing?